and scholar Irving Howe. The list also includes Stanley Sheenbaum of Los Angeles, who was one of the five American Jews to meet last year with Yasser Arafat in Stockholm, and Professor Jerome Segal of the University of Maryland, who drafted a plan for Palestinian statehood last year. The Jerusalem Post of June 4, 1988, contains the following report, datalined New York, and entitled Aloni Blasts Jewish Leaders in U.S. for Keep Quiet Policy. Citizens' rights movement MK Shlomi Aloni has blasted the conference of presidents of major American Jewish organizations as rich and fat people, who go to Israel, to rub shoulders with important people at nice dinners, and then come back to the US and rub shoulders with more important people. Aloni, who has just completed a two-week North American speaking tour, said she was convinced by the warm reception she had received that most American Jews oppose the positions of Prime Minister Shammai. She said they are also turning against the view of Maurice Abraham, chairman of the President's Conference, that American Jews should not take a public stand on issues relating to the Middle East peace process. Discussing the American Jewish leadership, Aloni said, "I never respected Abraham and the rest of these rich and fat people, because I don't know who they represent. They say that American Jews should keep quiet about what is happening in Israel, and take a position of my country right or wrong. But they never tell the right wing to keep quiet. It is only the liberals who are told to shut up." Aloni said that she had received warm receptions from synagogue audiences and UJA Federation groups in cities like New York, Miami, Montreal, and Toronto. "The Federation people in Miami, Toronto and Montreal were against me when I came. But as I spoke, the whole atmosphere changed. People came up to me afterwards and thanked me for giving them back their dignity and pride in being Jewish." Aloni told Jewish audiences, "If you have the right to speak out on human rights in countries all around the world, including Jews in the Soviet Union, you certainly have the right to speak out on human rights in Israel. How wrong does Israel have to be before you speak up? We have previously referred to and quoted from an article written by Henry Siegman, executive vice president of the American Jewish Congress, appearing in the December 31, 1988 edition of the Jerusalem Post. The article is entitled "The Diaspora's Right to Intervene," in which Siegman points out that Jewish unity is pointless if the result is that Israel goes down the tube. The unanswered question is whether enough voices will be raised loudly enough and soon enough to deal with the crisis at hand. Chapter 10: Israel in Crisis. NRI, he war in Lebanon differed from other Israeli wars in that it JL was, without any doubt, an offensive war, fought less for the benefit of Israel than for the personal aggrandizement of certain of its leaders, Menachem Begin and Ariel Sharon. The Lebanese War. 1982-1983. Perlmutter, in his book entitled Israel, the Partition State, discusses it under the caption Sharon's War in Lebanon, from which the following is quoted: "The start of the war was planned with measured debate by a government, which set itself a limited and specific goal in response to what it perceived as an intolerable and continued threat to its national security. The man whose responsibility it was to conduct that war, in order to accomplish his own plan, set about to manipulate his own prime minister, the cabinet, and the armed forces, thus extending the scope and duration of the war and its tremendous potential for larger tragedy, political fiasco, and disaster. Just as important, he misled Israel's American allies. The blame for the Lebanese war does not rest solely with former Israeli Defense Minister Ariel Sharon. Understanding the situation and events defies that kind of simplicity. But if there is a single person who bears the lion's share of the responsibility for the war's steady descent into disaster, it is Sharon. His plans led directly to the involvement of Syria in the war, to the tragedy at Sabra and Shatila, to the diplomatic and military entry of the United States into the swamp-like arena of Lebanon, and to the final collapse of Menachem Begin. Indirectly, his actions led to the disaster that befell the contingent without a mission of U.S. Marines who died in a bomb attack on their barracks in Beirut, emphasis supplied Perlmutter points out that Begin's motives fitted Sharon's ambitions. Sharon was helped in his ambitions by Begin's vision of fulfilling the old revisionist Jabotinsky dream of Eretz Israel. Begin saw the Lebanon operation as his crowning achievement, and he therefore did not need much persuading. Begin probably envisioned the strike as ensuring that he could be the prime minister who, by destroying the PLO, created a secure and united Eretz Israel. Sharon probably saw himself riding in triumph like some Roman praetor entering Jerusalem, the next king of Israel. Emphasis supplied, Huckabee's judgment is even harsher. In his book, Israel's Fateful Hour, under the heading of The Wages of Deception, Huckabee writes, the Lebanon War was accompanied by lies and deceit at the highest political levels. Defense Minister Sharon has been repeatedly accused of having misled Begin and the cabinet. This explanation was disseminated not by the opposition, but by sources within the Likud who are close to Mr. Begin. The accuracy of official announcements by Israel's military spokesman, which had always been considered trustworthy, now became suspect. The Israeli army is a people's army, and the home front soon became aware that army and government communiques contradicted what the public learned from first-hand observers. To provide a justification for the war, the Likud government also lied to the public by grossly exaggerating the terrorist acts conducted from Lebanon. Responding to a question in the Knesset, Defense Minister Rabin said that during the 11 months of the ceasefire that preceded the war, the northern settlements were attacked only twice, and that during this period Israel had suffered a total of 2 killed and 6 wounded from terrorist attacks. Moreover, these attacks were preceded by Israeli Air Force strikes in response to the planting of a bomb on a bus and the attack on the Israeli ambassador in London, Shlomo Argov. It was distortion at the highest political level to present terrorism as Israel's chief problem, when the major threats are in fact the demographic balance and the menace of war. Even the official pretext, the attack on Ambassador Argov, was at bottom a lie, since it was not carried out by the PLO, but by the secessionist faction of Abu Nidal, that had also assassinated PLO leaders. Emphasis supplied, Huckabee repeats what he has said elsewhere in his book, namely, that calls for a war against terrorism are often used by demagogues to distract attention from the real issues. In Huckabee's words, terrorism is grist for the demagogue's mill, the perfect topic for inciting public opinion, arousing popular fury, acquiring popularity. It is all too easy to harp on motifs like the right of Israelis to live in peace, and we must use strong arm tactics against terrorism, and so on. As I have already said, the problem is that there is no quick fix for terrorism, no military operation can put an end to it. The most damning indictment of Begin's motives in starting the war in Lebanon is found in these words from Huckabee's account of the war. Begin's principal motive in launching the war was his fear of the momentum of the peace process, that he might yet be called upon to honor his signature to the Camp David Accords and withdraw from the territories. Calling the Lebanon War the War for the Peace of Galilee is more than a misnomer. It would have been more honest to call it the war to safeguard the occupation of the West Bank. Emphasis, the disastrous war in Lebanon accelerated the decline in Israeli society from the zenith it had reached at the end of the 1967 war. Prior to the November 1988 elections, the moderates in Israel had expected, or at least hoped, that the fierce emotional fires that had been fueled by the preachings of the religious radicals and the demagoguery of the Likud would die down and be brought under control. As the November 1988 elections proved, it was a vain hope. The election results came as a shock to many people because of the significant political gains made by the religious nationalist extremist factions in the Likud party. Earlier, Amos Perlmutter had made a pre-election forecast, which appeared in the Los Angeles Times edition of September 28, 1988. In it, Perlmutter offers some profound observations concerning the political scene in Israel and expresses his feelings of nostalgia for the Israel of the past and his sense of foreboding for the Israel of the future. Perlmutter's article is entitled Beautiful Israel Wanes, Youthful Dream is Shed in a Hard Shift to Right. His observations are, in part, as follows. The 1988 Israeli elections, and their aftermath, will be a thunderous sea change in the 40-year history of Israeli politics.